You're listening to a selection of stories from this week's Morning Ireland.
We're going to Rosslare in County Wexford first this morning, where 16 people who were found inside a refrigerated trailer on a ferry were met by Gardaí, immigration officials and a medical team yesterday. We'll talk to a member of that team shortly. A ferry worker carrying out checks on the deck of the Cherbourg to Rosslare Stena Horizon heard noise from within a trailer. The driver was called for, the trailer was opened and 16 men were found inside. They're all male and believed to be from the Middle East. They were assessed at Rosslare Europort and transferred to an immigration reception centre and are all reported to be in good health. The discovery comes weeks after 39 people were found dead inside a container in England. Gardaí say that an Irish-based company owns the lorry involved yesterday and that the driver has been a resident of Ireland for more than 25 years. Here's Superintendent James Doyle of Wexford Garda Station at Rosslare Port last night.
They were discovered by staff on the Stena Horizon that they generally patrolled the lower deck and possibly heard noises coming from the trailer, and they summoned the driver who assisted with it. He came down and opened the trailer and they were discovered. We believe they're adult males between 20 and 35 years, however, one yet to be established whether he's juvenile.
They weren't banging to get out, were they? There was indication.
No, not that I'm aware of. I mean, that has been said, but that is to be confirmed.
What's happening at the moment then?
They're currently being processed under immigration legislation here at Rosslare Europort. At some point later this evening, they will be taken to a reception area in Dublin where they'll be cared for in terms of accommodation and food.
Have they cooperated with Gardaí in terms of telling them their identity and who they are?
That's part of the immigration process at the moment.
That's Superintendent James Doyle speaking in Rosslare last night. Let's speak to Ger Carthy now. He's an independent local councillor, chairman of the Rosslare municipal area. He's also an advanced paramedic and was part of the emergency response team who arrived at the Stena Horizon when it docked yesterday afternoon. Ger Carthy, good morning. Thanks for taking our call.
Morning, Gavin.
Tell me about what happened when you got to the ferry yesterday.
I suppose, Gavin, from the outset, I'm not a spokesman for the HSE, but as an independent councillor, on arrival down there yesterday, we were greeted by 16 young men who had alleged to have travelled for nearly 20 days to get to the port of Cherbourg. At some stage over the last 48 hours, they suspect that they entered the trailer in the port of Cherbourg and were bound for Rosslare Europort. In quite good spirits, I suppose, somewhat shocked at the traumatic situation that they found themselves in for nearly 20 hours in a container or trailer on the Stena Horizon en route to Rosslare Europort. And you can imagine like what kind of trauma that would bring. But fortunately enough, they were in relatively good spirits and in quite good health and were checked over by the National Ambulance Service staff, a number of consultants from Wexford General, nursing staff from Wexford General, and cared for by the immigration services through An Garda Síochána. At approximately 2:30, that operation began, and emergency services were notified around 11 a.m. yesterday morning that the boat was en route to the port of Rosslare.
How old did you say they were?
Between the ages of, as Superintendent Dial alluded to, between the ages of 18 and 35, one maybe of a juvenile, Kurdish, Iraqi possibly, and looking for a better life. We're led to believe that they may have been looking for asylum in the United Kingdom, but may have, probably got into the wrong trailer or been put into the wrong trailer. Now, that would form part of the investigation by the Gardaí, but that's what we're led to believe. I suppose the question we have to ask is, why do these people feel that they have to leave their own home country, and that's through persecution and war, etc. And the reason for that, I suppose, is a lot of it is to do around oil and trouble in the Middle East, and it's concerning for us as a nation, but it should be more concerning for the leaders of the European Union. And I suppose the challenge back, the checks and the balances that are being done in French ports maybe need to be improved, but that's not to keep people out, that's to protect their safety and, maybe stop what has yes. turned out to be okay yesterday, could have been disastrous.
Ger, what do you know of how they got onto the truck and how long they were in the trailer?
Well, we're led to believe that they've travelled for over 20 days and that they may have been in the truck for a number of days, but people that would be very well in the know don't suspect that to be from the condition that they were found in. If it was, there was dates stemming back from the 16th to the to yesterday, that, you know, that'd be 5 days in a trailer, and we don't think that would be the case.
That
would form part of the Gardaí investigation.
It was a refrigerated trailer, but it wasn't like the fridge wasn't on, is that right? Even though the Irish Times are reporting that the men were dressed for very cold conditions.
Yeah, that would be correct, and we're led to believe that the trailer wasn't on. No, fortunately enough, it wasn't. For those 16 individuals, you know, to put their life at risk for a better life on different shores.
Do you know what happened to the men after you saw them?
They were in Rosslare Europort in the immigration facility at approximately 8 o'clock last night, and they were due to be moved by the immigration services to a reception centre in Dublin as soon as they were processed through the immigration system, which was led there by Superintendent Jim Dyle.
And what did you have to do to help or assess them?
Well, they were assessed medically, you know, were they medically fit, had they any injuries, you know, any medical conditions that they, you know, there's an interpreter there as well, so to support us in our endeavours to help and support them and to weigh up their medical, the quality of their current condition, and they were deemed fit and put through the immigration system. So really what happened yesterday was, and I'd like to commend Wexford General Hospital and all the services, because the A&E or the emergency department actually went to the boat opposed to the casualties coming to the General Hospital with two senior consultants there yesterday on board Stena Horizon. So they're certainly to be commended for the work that they've done. And let's hope that this is a once-off, because, you know, in the mouth of Brexit, and we don't really know what way that's going to play out, it's an unknown. Let's hope that this isn't a common thing, because we certainly don't want to lose lives in boats or even on our shores here.
Do you expect this to happen again?
I probably would suspect so. There's seemingly in Cherbourg and that area at the moment, there's been a lot of infiltration into the port, and they've been successful, I suppose, in getting into a number of trailers and on axles and stuff. And that's, it's very concerning for those people themselves because of their safety, and, you know, who knows if the Stena Horizon, that if the member of staff hadn't heard the banging on the trailer, had the boat been diverted through bad weather — the weather was quite bad yesterday, it could have been hours and hours on end, and who knows, we could be looking at an Essex situation on the shores here in Rosslare Europort.
Ger Carty, thank you very much for speaking to us. That's Independent Councillor Ger Carty, who was also part of that paramedic team who assessed the men at Rosslare Port yesterday.
Britain's Prince Andrew does, after all, regret his friendship with the convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. The statement, in which he also announced that he was stepping down from public duties, came amid the continuing furore over his BBC television interview. In that interview, he denied claims by one of Epstein's accusers that she'd been forced to have sex with him, but he failed to express any sympathy for Epstein's victims and defended his friendship with the billionaire.
You've talked about a thick skin. Mm-hmm. I wonder if you have any sense now of guilt, regret or shame about any of your behaviour and your friendship with Epstein.
As far as Mr. Epstein is concerned, it was the wrong decision to go and see him in 2010. As far as my association with him was concerned, it had some seriously beneficial outcomes in areas that have nothing to do with what I would describe as what we're talking about today.
Prince Andrew speaking to Emily Maitlis of Newsnight. We're joined on the line by royal historian Kate Williams. How significant do you think was last night's announcement?
Last night's announcement was unprecedented. We are seeing a royal who has been a working royal for all of his life stepping back from public duties with no timeline. It's very possible that this is stepping back for good. This is retiring, when he's not even 60. So this is unprecedented in terms of its act. All the charities he's been a patron of, 200 or so, and all the business initiatives, they all... he's no longer with them. They will have to find new patrons. And obviously the statement itself was very significant. Just as you were saying, he actually now admits regret for his friendship with Mr. Epstein. When the Newsnight interview on Saturday night with Miss Maitlis that you're just playing a clip of, there were three big things that really stuck out to us. One were the bad alibis, the very bad alibis of Pizza Express and not being here or not being there. The other one was the complete lack of regret for his friendship with Mr. Epstein, even saying, "I don't regret it because I met interesting people." And then was no sympathy expressed for the victims. He was given plenty of opportunity, and not once did he say how terrible for these poor young girls and women that were trafficked by Epstein. And so we see in this statement an expression of regret, unequivocal regret, and also talking about sympathy for those affected by it. But really, this is too little, too late. The interview was a car crash, a catastrophe, and there's no way of coming back from it, really.
As you say, the interview was a disaster, but in a way, was it a surprise that he wasn't under more pressure before now?
Yes, I think that is true. The allegations from Virginia Roberts came in 2011 when the Mail on Sunday got an interview with her and the photo of them together upstairs in Ghislaine Maxwell's house that has been a big issue of discussion. It's been going on since then. And, you know, Andrew went there in 2010 and there was a huge furore then. And of course, then Mr. Epstein was arrested. Yes, I mean, really, I do think that possibly if it hadn't been for this interview, he might just about have got away with it, because speculation was dying down. No other powerful men had been dragged into the orbit. And Mr. Epstein, of course, died in prison and his secrets have gone with him. So it's possible that that would have been the case. But I think it's important that he does speak to the authorities. He says he's going to. I mean, everyone who ever went anywhere near Epstein should be speaking to the authorities and discussing this matter and saying what they saw, even if they saw nothing. And so Prince Andrew, who certainly seems to have been popped in more than once, should really have talked to them long ago and discussed this long ago. But really, what we saw on Saturday night was a man who thinks he was completely innocent, had no case to answer, did nothing wrong, never saw anything. And really, he said that he saw people in Epstein's houses, but he just thought they were like Buckingham Palace staff, so didn't pay any attention. So it is time, I think, that he was completely accountable to his actions, as anyone should be who was involved with Epstein. Any of us would have been asked to leave our jobs long ago if we'd been involved in this, but Andrew has got away with it for quite a long time.
It's just after 8:30, and I'll come to the news in a moment, but can I just ask you finally about that very issue, Kate, the question of cooperation with the American authorities. Do you think that there's now likely to be significant pressure on him to talk to law enforcement in the United States?
Yes, he said in the interview he'd do it if push came to shove. He said in his statement last night that it was going to be something he did. And certainly it's been said before that he couldn't go to America because he'd be asked to speak to them. I think now he will have to voluntarily go to America. Now, if there's any chance of getting his public reputation back, any chance of ever coming back in terms of public engagements at all, he will have to go and speak to them and make it publicly known that he's given the FBI all that he knows. And because simply, he is not above the law. He's a member of the royal family, but he's not above the law. And this is an ongoing investigation into Mr. Epstein and how far all of his crimes went out there.
Royal historian Kate Williams, thank you for talking to us on Morning Ireland.
It's almost the start of the Christmas shopping season, so this morning online shoppers are being advised what to do so that their bank details don't get hacked. Ulster Bank has carried out research which shows that almost a third of adults have shared their PIN or their password with someone they don't know, and nearly a quarter of the nearly 1,100 people questioned said they would take a chance on clicking on a link if it promised a great deal at the other end. Well, Denise Cusack is the bank's customer protection advisor. She's in our Limerick studio now. Denise, good morning.
Good morning, Audrey.
Do people think that they are able to be safer online than their behaviour would suggest?
I believe so. Look, I suppose just to point out first, Black Friday has fast become a household Christmas shopping event, and many of us, including those who might not normally go online, are now going online to try and grab a bargain. and many of them potentially shopping on the go. So they may be very, very rushed and have that sense of urgency to act quickly. So therefore, you know, they might think that they've took the necessary precautions, but shopping on the go, along with that sense of urgency, might result in a different outcome for them.
So the basics, never share your PIN or your password for your banking account.
Look, I think that's very important. And you mentioned the stats there. 1 in 10 shoppers have shared their online banking PINs and passwords. And look, those PINs and passwords are extremely precious and they should be treated that way and not shared at any point. And your bank will also never ask you for that information.
If you're buying online, though, Denise, how can you be absolutely 100% sure that the site that you're on is secure and safe?
It is a peak shopping period first, just to point that out. And that can be a hotspot for fraudsters. And scammers will take advantage using the likes of fake adverts, fake websites. So just a few things to look out for is to look out for potentially that green padlock. That would actually give you, I suppose, a sense of security that it is a secure website. And also use secure checkouts who are offering secure payment methods such as PayPal.
Well, that's a good point, isn't it? The PayPal or Stripe mm-hmm. or whatever, that's very clearly advertised, isn't it, when you go to pay?
Yes, and look, it is secure and they have their security promise there for their customers as well. But look, I would also say to shop websites that are known to you and that you're familiar with, and always read peer reviews on the items that you're buying, as well as on the website itself, if it's not something that you would use on a regular basis.
And if you're on your secure and your safe website, could it also be possible, though, for a link to appear to this so-called great deal that you will get if you click on it? Would that appear, or would that be linked to a secure and safe website to begin with?
Look, I think there's always a possibility that there may be a pop-up that would come up that you could potentially click on. But again, just being aware of never to click on a link or a pop-up in order to get to a main site. Always go into the main website yourself and never through a pop-up or a click.
All right, so never do that.
Yes, I would always say stop and think before you click.
Yeah, because what could happen at the end of that? I mean, are a lot of these clicks pure scams?
Look, not all of them, but it certainly is a way that scammers can get access to people is through those fake websites and the fake adverts. So I would say not all of them, but definitely it's something to be aware of. And again, just go through the main website, type in the main website address if you want to get a site, mm-hmm. get to a site, as opposed to clicking on a link or an advert.
Okay. And of course, people buy a lot of things through Facebook, through adverts that pop up on social media. What's the advice there? Presumably you should keep as much of your private details about yourself as private as you can.
Mm-hmm. I would look, don't divulge unnecessary personal information. Again, social media messaging that is out there, again, a hotspot for fraudsters. So, you know, just relax, don't be rushed, trust your instincts. And what I would say that if it sounds too good to be true, that it probably is.
Mm-hmm. And of course, the other thing is the devices that we use, our phones, our tablets, our laptops, we should try and keep them as up to date as possible with all the security fixes.
Yes, I would update your security fixes as often as possible. I think the survey showed that it had been more than a year since most of the respondents had actually updated it. But also to be aware of public Wi-Fi networks. I would definitely recommend to using your own data when shopping online or again logging into your online banking.
I'll just go over that a little bit again. So are you saying that if you're in a public place, don't log on to the public Wi-Fi?
I would say don't log on to the public Wi-Fi when you are logging on to your mobile banking app, or again, if you are purchasing something and inputting payment information such as your card details. Certainly use your own private data for that. It's certainly worth eating into your data plan.
Okay.
In terms of keeping safe.
Yeah, that's good advice. And in terms of the updating of the security, do most people know how to do that?
Look, there are lots of websites out there that are giving people information on how to download good security good security devices that will help keep your mobile and your computer safe and secure. Again, I would suggest using a well-known company to download that.
OK, well, thank you very much indeed for that advice this morning. Denise Cusack, who is Ulster Bank's Customer Protection Advisor, joining us live this morning from our Limerick studio.
This year, 5 women are known to have died violently in this country. That's according to Women's Aid, which publishes its annual femicide report this morning. It shows 230 women died violently here in the past 23 years. This morning, a seminar in Dublin will explore the links between domestic abuse and femicide. One of the guest speakers is Kathleen Chadda, whose husband killed their 2 young sons, Owen and Rory, 6 years ago. Kathleen is calling for more state supports for families of those killed in violent circumstances. She's been speaking to our reporter, Elise Sheehy.
For me, the message is very much about hope. And it's a strange word to use in something like this. But I think there are many circumstances where there are women out there, not to the extent that I've got to live through. So there are many women out there that are being abused, that are in homes that are filled with domestic abuse, domestic violence. There are children that are affected. Not all women or children are going to be killed. That is the extreme, and we know that. But they're living with that threat sometimes. And for the women that do come out of that, and the women that have lost lives or their children's life or even just the life as they know it, it is to say that there is life beyond that. So for me personally, it's important to remember that a lot of my life actually with Sanj and Owen and Rory was good. We had a happy life. We were a happy family. And if I was to actually allow anger and bitterness to take over, I'd lose all of that. Their last moments were the moments of violence and domestic violence that is a part of my life now every day, because the repercussions of that will never go away. But it's important for me to know, and I think to express out loud, that it's actually okay to acknowledge that there was good in that life as well.
And that brings us to the next point, that one of the big things is supports for families of bereaved. And this will be one of the big discussions at the conference today. So what are your thoughts on that?
I don't think there's enough support. Again, I go back to the fact that I consider myself very lucky in the support that I did have. I had an incredible psychologist, and I was lucky to have had access to that. That wasn't funded. There was no government organisation that came in and supported me in that way. And I think that is missing. I think it's missing for so many bereaved in particular, on whatever level. There are a lot of great charities out there, absolutely. But when you're in circumstances like I was, you've got family and friends around who are fantastically supportive. But they're all going through their own pain and loss and bereavement as well. So it needs to be something external, but it also needs to be somebody coming to you and knocking on your door for something like that. Because for me personally, I was in shock, and I stayed in shock for a long time. So I do think that there needs to be more awareness, there needs to be more understanding, and there needs to be investment at, be it, I don't know whether it's a HSE level, whether it's at a Department of Justice level, whether it's, but certainly at a government level.
Because you did make the point about supports, financial supports, and when it comes to counselling, offering counselling services and the funding that's provided there, and on the other level, free legal aid. Can you expand on that?
Legal aid never really came into it for me personally, but I do know that the salary that I was on at the time and am on still, because I was lucky enough that my job was kept open for me, I would have been above any threshold for that. And I think myself personally, if the perpetrator themselves falls under legal aid, no matter what their circumstances are personally, surely the victims of crime should also be. It shouldn't have to cost me, if you like, and I should have representation. And I think every victim should have representation at whatever level that might be, but certainly representation. My solicitor came with me, but he came with me for me. It wasn't mandatory, it wasn't something that I specifically requested. He came because he's a friend, and he was there to support me and to explain what was needed. I consider myself in many ways very lucky in the support that I got, But I've spoken to many, many out there that have not had the same support. So I had a really good Garda liaison officer who was able to explain a lot of things to me. I had a really good psychologist. They don't necessarily come naturally in every county in this country. They came very, very naturally and very cohesively for me. But I shouldn't feel lucky because of that.
Staying with the legal system, are there any particular changes that you would like to see?
As part of the campaign group that I work with, SAVE, which is Sentencing and Victim Equality, we have a very basic thing that we would love to see happen, which is minimum sentencing. So that at the end of a judge saying you're being sentenced to a life sentence, he can add in to serve a minimum of X number of years before consideration for parole. It would have made things a little bit easier for me 4.5 years ago when Sanj was sentenced. I do know that progress has been made with the parole bill, and that has made will make a difference. It actually makes a difference to me because it's 6 years since it happened, and I know that Sanj would have been applying for parole in a year's time, within the next year, which just seems incredibly cruel.
And finally, Kathleen, we spoke for a little bit before we started this interview, and you mentioned to me about the saying, the phrase, it's okay not to be okay. But you also have another phrase, and it's quite the opposite.
Which is that it's okay to be okay. So it is okay for me and for others in similar circumstances to smile, to laugh, to be happy, and to know that it's okay that Owen and Rory are not always to the forefront of my mind. So they're not always the first thing that I think about or the first people I think about when I wake up in the morning. And sometimes they'll be more prominent than at others. That was how it was when they were alive and with me. That's how any parent would be. You can't function, I think, without being able to prioritise. So you will see me smiling. You'll see me happy. You'll see me laughing. What you won't see are the days that I go, do you know what? I can't be bothered getting up today. Or you don't see me when I cry on the way to work because there's something on the radio or something has come to mind. But that's okay. That is okay. And at some point, the good days will outweigh the bad ones.
And that's Kathleen Chadha speaking there to Elise Sheehy.
The GAA will later this morning unveil headstones at Glasnevin Cemetery to honour three people killed in Croke Park 99 years ago today. It's the anniversary of what became known as Bloody Sunday, a day on which 30 people died, including 14 people shot dead by British forces in Croke Park, where Dublin and Tipperary were playing football. 8 of those killed in Croke Park were buried in unmarked graves. Today, gravestones will be unveiled over the resting places of 10-year-old Jerome O'Leary, the youngest victim, Patrick O'Dowd and Michael Feary. In a 1985 interview with RTE's Brendan O'Reilly, Tipperary player Bill Ryan recalled the events of that day.
First thing happened, the plane came over the pitch, came down very low and circled around over the plane pitch, went away. It was there gave the signal, of course, that the game was on. In a few minutes, it was surrounded and they started shooting. They came in the canal gears.
In the canal end?
Yes, they came in the canal gear 5 or 6 times and they fired 5 or 6 shots in so quick succession. Like. Yes. The ball was down near the railway and it was down in the near the Dublin goal at the time. I think I was out about the 50 yards mark. I was playing the half back there. When the shooting started, I looked back and all the crowd were rushing around inside the canal gate. And I saw Mick Hogan and a Dublin player coming running in my direction. Mm. So I turned and ran down the field then.
And were you aware that bullets were flying around?
Oh, yeah, you could hear the bullets whizzing.
Is that right? Mm. Mm. And were you aware that they were actually shooting into the crowd? Did you know that?
Well, we were. Mm. We were, because you could see... Phil is laying on his 16. Mm.
Bill Ryan speaking in 1985 to Brendan O'Reilly. With us are Michael Foley, sports journalist with the Sunday Times and author of The Bloodied Field, and Liam Dineen, who's a relative of Patrick O'Dowd, one of those being honoured today. Michael, will you bring us back, first of all, what happened on the 21st of November 1920?
Sure, yeah. Well, I suppose people will probably remember Michael Collins and the morning of the Sunday of the 21st of November was this famous attack on a group of British spies and agents by Michael Collins' squad. And there's 14 people killed in that particular attack across Dublin. So I suppose the feeling in the city after that was, it was the middle of the War of Independence, so the kind of, I suppose, the spiral of atrocity and reprisal. Once one crow did one thing, they expected the other crow to do something else, so the entire city was waiting to see what would happen next. In terms of Croke Park, the Croke Park massacre, I suppose, began initially actually as a search operation. The British authorities sent a combined force of Black and Tans auxiliaries and RIC up to Croke Park on the basis that they thought was people who may have been involved or may have had knowledge of what happened in the morning would probably have gone to the game or may have gone to the game. So it was essentially a search operation. They were to go in, stop the game, search everybody, and then allow them all to leave the ground. But in that context, I mean, it was doomed to be a disaster from the very beginning, because people were conditioned. Once they saw police, army arriving, people immediately would panic. And in this case, the canal, the trucks, the army trucks, police trucks arrived up onto the canal bridge, and instead of forming lines and following orders in terms of the search operation, Black and Tans auxiliaries, as I say, and RIC took up positions first on the canal bridge and started firing into the ground, and then more of them went in through the turnstiles at the corner, and they just started shooting randomly at people. It only lasted 90 seconds. It was just 90 seconds when you think about it. It's not a very long time, but it ended up with 14 people dead, and I suppose the kind of imagery and the kind of horror that you just do not associate with somewhere like Croke Park, somewhere where you go to enjoy yourself. It's kind of a place of dreams almost. You just do not expect that kind of thing to happen there.
When you wrote a book about that day, what, 4 or 5 years ago, you were struck by the fact that a number of those who were killed, a number of the 14, were in unmarked graves.
Yeah, like the book came out 2014, and at that stage, as I said, it was 14 victims, so 8 of them were in unmarked graves. And that kind of struck me, the fact that, you know, I suppose everybody feels they know something about Bloody Sunday, whether it's a bit in the morning or, you know, oh, and then there was a massacre in Croke Park and people died and so on and so forth. But the telling of the story up the years, whether it was, you know, how many people had died, the names, the circumstances, they'd sort of gotten mangled in the telling up the years. And that struck me initially when I was doing the book, and then at the end of it to realise that there was eight of these people in unmarked graves. That struck me very much, and it kind of happened at the same time that the GAA were thinking along the same lines, and some of the families were also thinking along the same lines. So from 2015 on, the GAA started the Bloody Sunday Graves Project, which was essentially an opportunity to get in touch with families and tell them, look, there's assistance there if you want now to go forward and erect headstones. Because there was a variety of different reasons why headstones weren't put up, whether it was economical. Some families felt that they wanted to wait until the trouble had died down, as it were, before they went and put up an appropriate gravestone. Some families were afraid of reprisals if they put something up. There was a number of different reasons why headstones didn't go up at the time. And of course, then the generations go on, and the story might go down through the generations, but, you know, the idea of putting up a headstone might get lost. So the GAA have been fantastically supportive in that, I have to say, and Cian Murphy in particular up in Croke Park has been brilliant in driving this. And there's 3 headstones today now.
One of those who'll be getting a headstone today is Patrick O'Dowd. Liam, tell us about Patrick O'Dowd. He was sort of your aunt's father, is
That's
that right?
I never met Patrick, obviously, but his daughter, his only daughter, Mary, was married to my uncle. And over the years, we lived very close by on Ignatius Road and near Binsbridge. And I always heard the story about this, my aunt's father having been shot in Croke Park, and that it took time to find his body. They didn't know where he had gone to the match like any other GAA supporter on a Sunday afternoon, and never came home. And there was worry and concern. And my aunt had lost a young brother at that stage through a flu. So her mother was waiting at home for her husband to come home, and he never came home. And they searched various hospitals and eventually found that he had died. And nothing appeared to have happened to the family. There was no apology, there was nothing. So that was the story I heard. And my aunt always talked about this with regret and sorrow and sadness. And so about 2 years ago, I was approached by Michael. They contacted me, even though I'd moved away from the area long since. And neighbours or friends had contacted. And so I said, of course I'd be delighted, because it would bring closure to my aunt. And I feel rather a little bit emotional over the past while dealing with this, because I know now that she is happy.
You think it
some tribute has been
to
given
her.
To her father, whom she loved and missed as a young child. She missed him. She was probably 16, 17 when he died. She'd lost a young brother, and she was left with her widowed mother and a son, another brother, who was slightly disabled, and she was left to fend for herself in poor circumstances, and no pensions or nothing in those kind of days, so it was rough. But when she married my uncle, they lived beside us in Binsbridge, and they had a shop, a grocery shop, and were well known in the area, and life moved on from there. They never had any family. And I had five sisters and myself.
All right, so you ended up spending quite a bit of time with them,
with
I'd
them
say.
Working in the shop. And,
and that's how you became familiar with the story.
Yeah.
Michael, another of those being remembered today, he was just 10.
Mm, yeah. Jerome O'Leary's 10 years of age. And the same as Liam and all the other families, we did our best to trace as far back as we possibly could to find any family for Jerome, but the family line is no longer there. Jerome was 10 years of age. He lived on Blessington Street in the inner city. And the story of James, essentially a 10-year-old boy, goes to a match, and someone could remember seeing him actually being put up on the wall. There was a wall that ran along the back of the canal goal. And when the shooting started, he was probably the second victim. The first victim was an 11-year-old boy who was sitting in a tree in at the corner. If people can think of the geography of Croke Park, where the canal end is now, or the Davin end is now, and what we call now the Hogan Stand, there was a set of trees there. So William Robinson was 11 years of age. He was sitting in the tree. He was the first victim shot. And the second victim was probably 10-year-old Jerome O'Leary. So, you know, sometimes people, again, it's that idea. I always feel that, you know, to get to the heart of this Bloody Sunday story, you have to go to the victims. You have to kind of try and engage with that feeling of the victims. And, it only occurred to me during the week. I was 10 years of age when I went to my first match in Croke Park. And I can remember the excitement of going. And you know what? It doesn't even, you know, for people thinking about this, like, I mean, it doesn't even have to be Croke Park. Just think of the first time you went somewhere at 8 or 9 or 10 years of age, and the excitement and the memories you had. And Jerome would have been the same going to that game. And he never came home.
The other thing is, Liam, finally back to yourself, is I suppose this is a reminder in some ways of how recent this all is, that, you know, you knew your aunt so well, and it was her father was one of those killed.
That's right. And she missed him for the rest of her life, and she never had closure on it, because and she took her, when she got married to my uncle a short time later, they took her brother to live with him, because her mum had died. So it was a sad kind of a beginning of life for them. But today I think is a great tribute to the GAA and to Michael for doing this great research. And I think it's an honour and a treasured memory that I will have and pass on to future generations as well. I was a teacher. I taught in O'Connell Schools. I taught in Cloisterwiry in Joey's. So I was a GAA person all my life. I went to Croke Park with my uncle, being lifted over the stiles. And I remember the emotion of going to those games, and yet thinking back that this was a spot where my uncle, and I believe, according to Michael's research, he appeared to have been a great hero. He helped save many other children and people.
He was sitting on a wall, and the last thing he did was pull someone over the wall to the other side. And the person he helped over the wall remembered afterwards that the person who helped him over the wall landed on him.
It's quite a story. Thank you both very much for joining us on the programme this morning, Michael Foley and Liam Dineen.
We're going to hear now about some rarely seen photographs. Later this week, Ireland in Focus, photographing the 1950s, will open to the public for free at the National Museum at Collins Barracks in Dublin. The exhibition has rarely shown images from three photographic collections, including that of an American anthropologist and photographer who lived in Kinvara in County Galway for a short period in the 1950s. Our reporter Cian McCormack met some of those photographed by him all those decades ago, and he also found out more about the exhibition.
The 1950s.
It was a very difficult decade. We were just after the war, economically very, very difficult.
A decade of change in Ireland.
Maybe, baby, I'll have you.
Immigration was at its one of its worst periods in our history. It was a community in change.
And a time when Paris-based American anthropologist and photographer Robert Cresswell was focusing his camera on Kinvara in County Galway.
So he came to Ireland with the idea that he would do an anthropological study of a rural area.
Dr. Fidelma Molan, a Galway-based cultural geographer, explains.
One of his big interests in selecting Kinvara was there was still enough people left here who hadn't been hit by emigration. And he lived here in the community for 15 months.
In a small thatched cottage on the outskirts of Kinvara, Patricia Martin remembers an encounter with Cresswell in the 1950s.
You're after handing me a beautiful black and white photo. Can you describe it to me?
Yeah, two lovely girls. My hair's all the one length around. It was taken here in Dungora. It's not the back of the house, yeah.
And Robert Cresswell was the name of the man who took the... Can you remember him?
Oh, I can, yes. We kept him for one night, I think, because Winkle's Hotel was full over in Kinvara. And he stayed here for one night. So we were kneeling down saying the rosary and he was looking at us. And I don't think he had any religion. I don't know. But he was just looking at us anyways, see what we were doing.
Many people remember Cresswell visiting Kinvara.
1955, he used to come down to our house for a cup of tea in the morning.
82-year-old Jim Brogan is standing at the site of the house he grew up in.
It was right here, and that was a garden to the back. You see the tree there?
And in that garden is where Cresswell took a photo of Jim and his family.
The only excitement I remember is that we all had to dress up and put on our best suits. And my mother, that was a big operation.
Jim's brother, Michael, also remembers Cresswell.
My mother did dress us all, but she dressed us all in clothes practically that she made herself at the time. That was a feature of those times. And there being 14 of us, of course, it was passed down from one to the other.
Cresswell's work is important because he captured Ireland at a time of great change. Dr. Audrey Whitty, Head of Collections and Learning at the National Museum of Ireland, explains.
It's a very good visual reference point for us as a nation right now, where you see how radically things have changed. You'd hardly recognise Ireland of the 1950s to Ireland of 2020. And I think what was very interesting about Cresswell's images is that he was very interested in what the Germans would refer to as the Volk, the people, and I mean the real people. So everything in terms of everyday life fascinated him. And I'm sure you've touched on the slaughtering of the pig and rural life in terms of, I suppose, the necessities of having to survive as well.
Patricia Martin remembers that bloody episode, the killing of the pig.
Oh, the screeching used to be terrible. Then to the black pudding and the white puddings.
So someone would kill their pig and the whole community.
Yeah, we'd all get a bit of it. But the big shots got it first. They were great times. We enjoyed them.
Cresswell's work is part of an exhibition called Ireland in Focus, photographing the 1950s. Dr. Fidelma Molan is the curator.
You will see a photo of the killing of the pig. People looking at it could interpret this as something very cruel in rural Ireland. But this was part of a normal traditional practice that's carried out throughout the world even today.
Robert Cresswell is one photographer. There are other photographers as well. Who are they?
There are two other photographers. The idea behind the exhibition is that we are looking at how people came from outside and how they saw Ireland. In the case of the two other photographers, they were professional photographers, one being Henri Cartier-Bresson. Cartier-Bresson was world-renowned. He had photographed Gandhi just 2 hours before he was assassinated. And we're going to be showing 20 printed images that he took around Ireland, including the ones of horse racing. And we're also showing 30 more digitally. And these ones have never been shown anywhere before. The other photographer, the third photographer, was an extraordinary American woman. Her name is Dorothea Lange. She photographed the Great Depression in America. She was sent by Life magazine to Ireland, and she ended up going to County Clare. And there she took 4,000 photographs, I think, of life in County Clare at the time.
Photographs on the radio, beautifully described by Cian McCormack and his guests, including Fidelma Mullan, the curator of Ireland in Focus, photographing the 1950s. It's on at the National Museum of Ireland at Collins Barracks in Dublin. It'll be opening to the public on Thursday, from Thursday of this week. The President, Michael D. Higgins, will be launching the exhibition on Wednesday. If you're interested and you want to see it, you can get more information at museum.ie.
A 26-year-old Dublin man has pleaded guilty in a New York court to assaulting Longford man Danny McGee, who died after being punched outside a pub in Queens last year. Stephen O'Brien, with an address at 42nd Street, Queens, New York, will serve 6 months in prison for the offence. The sentence was agreed as part of a plea deal at Queens County Criminal Court yesterday evening. Our Washington correspondent Brian O'Donovan, who was in court, has been telling me about the background to the case.
Well, it was 1 year ago today, actually, the 21-year-old Longford man, Danny McGee, was found by emergency services lying unresponsive outside the Gaslight Bar in Queens, New York. It was shortly before 4 a.m. on Thanksgiving Day last year, November 22nd. Danny McGee was taken to hospital but later pronounced dead. The New York City medical examiner carried out a post-mortem and found bruising to Danny's face, a cut on the top of his head and facial fractures. It was ruled that Danny McGee had died from a blunt impact injury to the head. 26-year-old Dublin man Stephen O'Brien turned himself into police in New York the following day. He was accused of punching Danny McGee once to the side of the head after they became engaged in a verbal row. Now, Stephen O'Brien was charged with third-degree assault, and on the eve of the anniversary of Danny McGee's death, Mr. O'Brien pleaded guilty yesterday in Queens County Criminal Court.
So what then happened in court following that guilty plea?
Well, it was a pretty short hearing, really, Brian. Everything was wrapped up in less than 10 minutes. It began with the defendant's lawyer, Matthew Gartenberg, the assistant district attorney, Kevin Ramnarain, and the judge talking for several minutes among themselves at the judge's bench, finalising the details of a plea deal. The prosecutor, Kevin Ramnarain, then took members of the McGee family outside to explain the plea deal to them. On the defence side, Stephen O'Brien's lawyer took him outside to explain the deal to him. Then they all came back in. The prosecutor addressed the court. He said, all sides had agreed to a prison sentence of 6 months in return for a guilty plea. Kevin Ramnarain, the prosecutor, said no period in jail would bring Danny McGee back and that no one will be happy with this, but he said he hoped there might be some solace from the fact that the case had finally come to a conclusion. The defence lawyer, Matthew Gartenberg, expressed remorse on behalf of his client, Stephen O'Brien, and after the hearing, I spoke to Matthew Gartenberg outside the court.
It's a very tough day for everyone involved here, and we're happy to be able to have closure to this for all parties. Everyone loses here, and there's no winners involved, and it's very sad for everyone, but we look forward to moving on with everyone's lives here.
Your client was quite upset there at the end. He apologized to the family. How is he feeling right now?
He's remorseful, very apologetic, and he's very sad about the whole thing. It's been a very tough year, and it's a life-altering experience, which hopefully no one ever has to go through or experience.
Brian, a number of the McGee family were also in court.
That's right, Brian. Yeah, family and friends of Danny McGee filled up about three rows of seating in the courtroom. The court was told that 36 relatives and friends were in attendance, and many of them had travelled over from Ireland for the hearing. And there were emotional scenes inside the courtroom as the details of Stephen O'Brien's plea deal and prison term were read aloud. Stephen O'Brien's lawyer said that his client would make a comprehensive statement when he is sentenced in January, but the judge said that considering the family were all in court now, would he like to say anything at this stage. So Stephen O'Brien turned, he faced the family, he wiped tears away from his eyes, and he said, "I know nothing I say can ever change anything, but I'm very, very sorry." Members of the McGee family at this stage also started crying and weeping, and outside the court after the hearing, they gathered in a group, hugging each other, and Danny McGee's mother, Colleen, spoke to the media.
"I suppose I'm glad that it's over one full year later. This could have happened many months ago. There really are no winners here today. Regardless of what happened, Danny will never come back. We miss him every second of every day. And that's how it's going to be."
When Stephen turned around and looked at your family and you and said he was sorry, did you feel true remorse? And he was crying.
"Listen, I'm sure his intentions weren't to do what he did. But nevertheless, it happened. With these results, his life has probably also taken a turn for the worst. But you have to stand up and take responsibility for what you've done and pay the price for it."
"Is 6 months enough?"
"I don't think anything would have made me happy today. There's nothing going to bring Danny back. Whether he went for 6 months, 6 years, it's not going to make a change in my life going forward."
Tell us about Danny. What kind of guy was he?
Danny was a wonderful, wonderful kid. He was only 21 years old. He had his whole life ahead of him. He was an adored son. He was an older brother, friend to his brother Brian and his sister Eva. He was a friend to everyone, young and old. He was caring. He was funny. He was a great kid. And everybody misses him.
Danny McGee's mother, Colleen, speaking outside the court in New York yesterday. Brian, what happens now?
Well, Brian, because this case was a third degree assault, the maximum sentence Stephen O'Brien could ever have received was 1 year. He was originally going to plead not guilty, and his trial was due to start yesterday. Instead, as part of this plea deal, he pleaded guilty yesterday in return for that 6 month prison sentence. Now, Stephen O'Brien was not jailed yesterday. He was released on continuing bail and will have to return to court on January 8th. For sentencing.
Our Washington correspondent Brian O'Donovan speaking to me earlier.
That's All Over Now by the Cranberries, the single from their album In the End, which has just been nominated for a Grammy Award, a first for the band. The album was released earlier this year and features vocals from lead singer Dolores O'Riordan, recorded before her death in January of last year. Noel Hogan, guitarist for the Cranberries, is with us. Noel, good morning.
Good morning. Hi. And
congratulations on the nomination.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
Tell me about how the album was put together.
The album, we went into the studio, I guess it was April of last year, and which some might think is very soon after Dolores passed away, but it was actually our producer, Stephen Street, at the time. When we went to him with the demos, he was the one that suggested. He could see, you know, how much emotion there was at that time between myself and the other two boys in the band, and he felt that we should kind of try and capture that in a way. And looking back now, we think he was right, because the thought of not doing it for a year or whatever, letting time go by, I don't know if you'd want to go back and face it again. Once we thought about it for a week or two, we decided we would go ahead, and we started that April.
Because you started putting it together in April 2017, after not having recorded together in a long time before that.
Yeah, that's right. We were on tour, and we were doing, it was like an acoustic tour of kind of our greatest hits. Dolores and I began that conversation of how nice it would be to write new songs again and play new songs, and the following tour would have been the tour for this album then. And we were in different countries, but that wasn't unusual for us, and sending ideas over and back. And because of that, I had all these vocals then, when Dolores passed away, we had spent from like kind of June until December kind of concentrating on this album. So I had all these vocals with the demos, so it was just a case of seeing were the vocals good enough that they would do justice for Gloris's memory. And after like putting the demos, kind of cleaning them up a bit and speaking with her family, we decided that we would go ahead with the album.
How was she during the recording?
Great. I mean, she was on a kind of a new high, really, because she'd been through a rough few years, and Gloris was very, very open about all of this. And, you know, she had mental health issues. She had kind of sorted those out. She'd been recently divorced, and she felt like that was all behind her now, and she was moving on to a new stage of her life. And that's what kind of really made the whole thing harder when the news broke that she'd passed away. I'd only spoken to her a day or two before, and you know, she was in really, really good form and looking forward to, we were actually meant to go to China and tour soon after that, and that was the discussion we were having that day. So it just makes it a lot harder to kind of accept it when it first happened.
Did recording the album help with coping to lose her?
Yeah, I think so. Now, I don't think you realise it at the time, but looking back, it was like, I guess, a form of therapy for us in some ways. And it also gave us a focus away from everything that had gone on. You were very much focused on getting the album as good as you could. And the thought of doing, of kind of going through that stage of our lives again without having this, I don't really know how we would have done it.
Listening to the album, Noel, a lot of the songs reference things coming to an end. It's quite dark, and not unlike some of, we'll say, the darker Smiths material, which I know you were all heavily influenced by.
Yeah.
Were you worried or concerned at all that listeners will be, and to hark back to an accusation that was pointed at the Smiths, that listeners would be inspired by the album?
No, we knew what the subject matter was about, and it, as I said a minute ago, it was really about things coming to an end and things that, you know, a part of Dolores' life that she was now leaving behind her and moving on. I guess the worry we had was that Dolores passed away, and then there was a lot of speculation of what had happened, and we knew people would probably go, oh, you know, she's singing about ending everything. It was just, I guess, part of our job in the promotion of this album was to really kind of push the point that this is not what this album was about. This was written as just another Cranberries album. And if you listen historically to a lot of our albums, there's always been that kind of darkness.
Yes.
There. I think it's kind of one of the charms of the Cranberries is you get almost kind of poppy rock music with this undercurrent of darkness within the lyric a lot of the time.
Her mother Eileen released a statement saying Dolores would be so happy with this. She put her heart and soul into her songs and music. For us as her family, it's kind of bittersweet. We're immensely proud yet saddened that she isn't here to witness and enjoy this, although I feel that she is in spirit. What do you think she would have made of a first Grammy nomination for the band? We were stunned when we realised that this morning. We thought you definitely would have got something for
no.
Zombie or for Linger before this.
Yeah, I think she'd be over the moon. Probably as shocked as the three of us are, because none of us expected this. It came out of the blue yesterday, and I think she would really, really be genuinely chuffed with the whole thing, because it's something we never even discussed over the years. It's funny, because you never nominated her, it's never mentioned around you. You almost forget about it a lot of the time. And as Eileen said, it's bittersweet, really, that it comes now at the tail end of it all, and Dolores isn't here to see it.
Noel, how are you and the rest of the band now?
We're good. You know, time passes on, and like, we never, you know, a day wouldn't go by where you wouldn't forget her. You know, I mean, you'll always remember her. And but I mean, you kind of get on with things, and as I said, this album, the way it was received as well, it has definitely helped the whole process.
Noel, lovely to talk to you. Thank you very
you.
Much for taking our call this morning. That's Noel Hogan, guitarist with the Cranberries.
You've been listening to a selection of stories from this week's Morning Ireland.